The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Exelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Rejecting responsibility, and what does accepting it really mean if no serious correction or punishment follows in government, finance, foreign policy?
Election fallout, how the voting in Virginia, New Jersey, and elsewhere last week may shape next year's battle for Congress and the White House in 2014.
Say what? The author of a recent book on deafness, including her own, touts a new technology that could help many in the growing ranks of hearing impaired.
Supporting SEALs. In advance of Veterans Day, the head of the SEAL Foundation talks about helping former Navy Special Warriors and their families.
The Other Wizards of Oz. A new cabaret show celebrates the songwriting of Yip Harburg and Harold Arlen before and after Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of November 10th and Veterans Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Exelberth.
Hold me accountable for the debacle. Okay. I'm responsible.
I am sorry that they are finding themselves in this situation based on assurances they got from me. We've got to work hard to make sure that they know we hear them.
There never would have been a shutdown if Harry Reid and President Obama hadn't said, we will not compromise, we will not negotiate, shut the government down. But it is worth also focusing on what did happen, because a lot, I think, was accomplished in the last couple of months. Number one, the public debate over the harms that Obamacare is inflicting, it elevated the public debate.
It took days of mounting criticism over the troubled launch of Obamacare, even from some loyal Democrats, for President Obama himself even to approach the kind of apology and acceptance of accountability that Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius had offered earlier last week at a contentious House hearing. And Texas Senator Ted Cruz took more credit than blame for the 16-day government shutdown he helped to inspire in a fruitless effort to defund, delay, and delegitimize the program even before its problems became fully clear.
A retreat from responsibility has also been evident in the continuing controversy over surveillance excesses at the National Security Agency, security deficiencies in the attack that killed Americans at a diplomatic post in Benghazi, Libya, and Wall Street crimes paid for with fines that set records but remained within the cost of doing business. To talk about the absence of accountability in so much of the government and commerce today, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Michael Brenner, University of Pittsburgh Professor Emeritus and Fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins.
But first, some numbers. Approval of the president remains down around 40% and far lower for Congress and the Republicans. The Office of Management and Budget last week reported the cost of the shutdown between $2 and $6 billion in lost economic output and government back pay for 6.6 million non-work days. Unemployment ticked up from 7.2 to 7.3%, but there was good news in the 204,000 new jobs added last month, and the week ended with a record high 15,761 Dow Jones average. Now to Professor Brenner, welcome back to the program.
Oh, pleased to be with you.
Talk about the differences between responsibility and accountability on paper and in practice, especially in terms of penalty.
Well, I think we should bear in mind that accountability is really at the heart of any democratic system, and particularly, you know, American democratic system. If public officials cannot be held accountable for their performance, then, you know, this erodes sort of the principle that, you know, government representatives and officials are representatives of the people, as you know, the word explicitly says, is accountable to them. The only way that accountability, though, can be, you know, take on practical meaning is if there are penalties. In other words, just a verbal statement that, yes, I'm responsible, as Secretary Sebelius made before the House committee, or more belatedly, President Obama, in regard to those persons who will be losing what they find more than satisfactory sort of insurance, means absolutely nothing in practical terms.
But don't we usually consider that accountability taken care of by regular elections every 2 years for members of Congress, every 4 years for the president? You're not really suggesting something like Egypt, where millions go out in the street to make a change in between elections.
No, although it wouldn't be a bad idea if American citizens directly and indirectly through the media were more vocal in expressing their discontent and their expectations that when there are manifest errors, there's something to be done about them.
Do you think that we would see a Sebelius resignation if the contentious partisan gridlock on Capitol Hill politics in Congress didn't threaten to block the nomination of any successor?
No, I don't. That might be true, but I really don't think that's a factor in the equation. The truth is that nobody resigns these days, or nobody is fired these days, because that's considered for two reasons. One, administration is considered to be that more of an embarrassment than the continuation in office. And two, there is really not very much of a hue and a sort of cry for these people to accept what is not just punishment, but a due judgment on their performance, and that is a judgment on the competence to perform the public duties to which they've been appointed.
There actually have been some resignations announced at the NSA command, or do you see that as the White House looking for scapegoats?
No, well, the NSA thing, those moments, I think, have absolutely nothing to do with the revelations of the excesses, and I would view them as sort of abuses of NSA surveillance. I mean, don't forget you have Mr. Clapper, who is Director of National Intelligence, who perjured himself, in other words, committed a crime before Senate committees and lying directly and explicitly in regard to, in response to a question as to what the NSA was doing. In other words, he considered what he did was a criminal act. And, you know, we certainly, one should be able to agree that the application of the law should not depend on political circumstances. So we have an example of that in terms of Clapper. And we also have even the more extraordinary. By the way, I think this phenomenon extends beyond the federal government and even beyond governments generally. After all, the man responsible for the Department of Justice Attorney General, sort of Eric Holder, who is sworn to uphold the laws of the land, said quite explicitly that some big banks will not be penalized, or no legal action will be brought against them, even if the judgment on the part of department lawyers is that they committed crimes, simply because the consequences would be too unsettling for the national economy. Well, I mean, I think that this is simply unacceptable.
Of course, history will have to judge the wisdom and responsibility of President Obama in pressing for a deal to lift some sanctions against Iran in exchange for a temporary freeze on their nuclear program to permit talks on some long-term compromise. What's your view of those negotiations that Israel and some Arab nations see as so threatening?
Well, I think it's clear at this point that on the Iranian side, there is a desire to reach a deal. But that doesn't mean that it's unqualified. And the sticking points, as I understand them, are going to have to do with the recognition on the part of the West and indirectly, the world community, or a large part of it, that Iran will retain the right that is legally Iran's to continue to develop civilian elements of the fuel cycle. There's no guarantee that this interim agreement, which has been outlined, will be realized. I think there's good reason to hope, though, that that it will be. Because then that would clear the way for a normalization of relations with Iran that could have positive repercussions throughout the region.
Michael Brenner, University of Pittsburgh Professor Emeritus and Fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins.
Quote from the news, am I an addict? No. Have I tried it? Probably in one of my drunken stupors. That was Toronto Mayor Rob Ford admitting that he had smoked crack, as a long secret video demonstrated, but he said he had no plans to step down.
Next, lessons from last week's elections for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Nobody should take my word as a good reason for investing in anything. That was former Star Trek star Patrick Stewart after helping to ring the New York Stock Exchange bell and launch the initial public offering of Twitter. Initially valued at $26 a share, it quickly rose to $50, then settled at $44 for a total value of $31.7 billion, though Twitter has yet to make a profit. Now this.
We stand here tonight showing that it is possible to put doing your job first, to put working together first, to fight for what you believe in, yet still stand by your principles and get something done for the people who elected you.
Over the next 4 years, most Democrats and Republicans in Virginia want to make Virginia a model for pragmatic leadership that is friendly to job creation.
Off-year gubernatorial elections are not famous for predicting subsequent races for Congress or the White House, but polls and pundits could not help looking for lessons from the big two last week. New Jersey celebrity Governor Chris Christie won a sweeping re-election bid against minor Democratic opposition with significant support from many constituencies that most conservative Republicans have found hard to get, especially women, minorities, and even Democrats. And he underscored that contrast with Tea Party purists in a victory speech whose subtext was clearly the presidency.
In Virginia, longtime Democratic fundraiser Terry McAuliffe beat Tea Party darling Ken Cuccinelli, but far more narrowly than expected, in part because of Democratic dissatisfaction with the rollout of Obamacare. Indeed, Tea Party leaders claimed they could have won had not mainstream GOP funders shied away from their conservative candidate, as they did with a Tea Party congressional candidate in Alabama, and increasingly in other races as well. To consider the dynamics of last week's elections and their impact on politics in next year's races and beyond, for your ears only, we're joined again by Norman Ornstein, American Enterprise Institute resident fellow and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, now updated in softcover from Basic Books. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, David.
In Virginia, Tea Party activists are furious at being written off by the National Party and big donors. Do you think more money would have overcome increasing Democratic dominance in the state's most populous regions, especially in the Washington area?
I'm not sure of that. I think, you know, what ended up happening is that a race that appeared to be pretty safe for McAuliffe, a lead of 7 points or so consistently for some period of time, changed because most Republicans came home. There was still a lot of ambivalence among Republicans and even some independents. And the big difference here really was that the Democrats turned out. That was because of McAuliffe's efforts. The interesting thing, though, is that because so many Tea Party activists think they could have won and now have even more resentment for the establishment wing of the party, you're likely to see an even deeper split on the Republican side, and very few of these Tea Partyites believing that they're on the downswing with the electorate.
Well, then, do you think that the movement of mainstream Republican funding away from Tea Party favorites will become a defining factor in primary contests for next year's congressional races?
We are really starting to see a change in tactics by some of those funders, and that includes the big funders from the past, like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, who gave a lot of money to some of these more extreme candidates, now moving to tilt that money in a different direction. You have a determination on the part of some of the establishment figures. I think you're going to see a more aggressive action in primaries, and that is going to fuel some additional tension within the Republican Party, which has unknown consequences. It's possible, at least, that some of these Tea Party types will decide, if they don't get their way, that they're not going to turn out in the fall. And in the midterm contest in 2010, that was what really made the difference. They turned out in force.
There's talk of mainstream Republicans going further and changing their nominating process itself, especially when it comes to the next presidential race. What's your view on that?
I'm not sure it'll make a huge difference. I think by the time we get to the presidential contest, we're going to see within any of the normal bounds of what you could do in a nomination battle, which is you can move to more caucuses, although the caucuses away from primaries can actually give an edge to the intense activists. You can try and change the order of those primaries. The activists who tend to be on the Tea Party side are still pretty dominant there. And I think if you look at, certainly the Chris Christie victory gives some traction to the pragmatists, that there are ways for a conservative but mainstream Republican to appeal to a broader electorate, including Hispanics and to women. You know, the problem that they've got, though, is a bigger one. If you look at every other presidential candidate, potential one out there who's in Congress, from Marco Rubio to Ted Cruz to Rand Paul in the Senate, all the way over to Paul Ryan in the House, they all voted against the deal that ended the shutdown. That tells me that when they look at where the Republican Party is going and the tendency, they're not looking in a Chris Christie direction. They're looking much more in that Ted Cruz direction right now.
The anger over Obamacare is dramatic at this early stage, but how important do you think it will be in next year's elections when the problems have been solved or the president is forced by facts to order some major changes or delays?
Well, one of the things that we need to be cautious about, and you noted this in your introduction, we always tend to make these extended linear projections from where we are now. It's always a mistake to take an off-year election, the Chris Christie election, the Virginia election, or any of the others now, and extrapolate anything to the future. They tend to be pretty idiosyncratic. When we had the government shutdown and the trauma that was caused there, a lot of people thought that that would have enormous impact on the midterm elections in 2014. You know, five or six big things are going to happen between now and then, and one of the big things that did intervene was the debacle over the rollout of healthcare.gov. But my guess is, just as we saw with the rollout of the Medicare prescription drug program, in the end, these early hiccups become a big story for a few weeks or a couple of months, and they're gone, and something else will be more important.
The Latino vote for Christie and McAuliffe was significant. What signs do you see that the current GOP House majority will finally back immigration reform with some type of legalization for millions of current residents, or that House Speaker John Boehner will permit a floor vote that a bipartisan majority could carry?
You know, the odds are not great for this, even though objectively and pretty obviously it would be to the advantage of the Republican Party to try and move this very divisive immigration issue that's killing them, not just with Hispanic voters, it's hurting them with Asian Americans as well. The message is that you have a party that's hostile to people who don't look like us. Getting that off the table would be huge. But John Boehner is not in a position where he, except on very rare occasions in the middle of a crisis, is willing to bring something up on the floor that will get support from more Democrats than Republicans. And right now, there's a hardening of attitudes on the immigration issue.
Norman Ornstein is an American Enterprise Institute resident fellow and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, now updated in softcover from Basic Books.
Quote from the news, I am mourning Yasser again. That was Suha Arafat, widow of the late Palestinian leader, after a report by Swiss scientists that forensic tests of his remains supported long-held suspicions that he was poisoned with radioactive polonium-210. Israel denied responsibility. Also last week, peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians were reportedly making little progress.
Next, new help for the hearing impaired. Now, so many of us, for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Fortunately, this moved like a Porsche. That was Philippines weather forecaster Michael Padua on the worst ever Typhoon Haiyan, 300 miles wide with record winds at times around 200 miles an hour, whose limited time over the island nation also limited the damage it could do. Still, initial reports indicated at least 100 dead, and experts say the final toll could be a dozen times that. Now this.
Just think of those shocks you got, and those knocks you got, and those bruises you got from those news you got, and those pains you got, and any pains you got from those little radios.
Times have changed, Cole Porter wrote to start the song Anything Goes in 1934. That was actually him singing it. And times have changed a lot more since then, for the worse as far as our brains and ears go. In place of those little radios, we have crashing rock concerts, screeching police and fire sirens, uncontrolled car alarms, booming movie and home hi-fi systems, not to mention waves of rap and war game violence wired right into the earbuds so many seem to wear, all of which may well contribute to more and earlier deafness than ever before.
Former New York Times editor Catherine Boughton last week published an essay on the Bloomberg View website about a little-known technology called looping that could help many of the hearing impaired. Boughton's study of deafness, including her own, was published earlier this year, titled Shouting Won't Help, Why I and 50 Million Other Americans Can't Hear You, from Sarah Crichton Books, Farrar, Straussen, and Giroux. And to talk about the book, Looping, and her ongoing life with limited hearing, for your ears only, Catherine Boughton is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We tend to think of hearing loss as something that only happens to the elderly, but that's far from true. Give us some statistics.
Yes, the perception is that hearing loss is a condition of aging, and in fact, two-thirds of those over 75 have hearing loss, but the majority of people with hearing loss are under 60, is 55%. True age-related hearing loss after the age of 70, affects only 8% of men and 16% of women. The rest of that huge group, that two-thirds, were already losing their hearing before they got old.
So even though such a huge percentage of people have hearing loss, there are still stigmas attached. Talk about some of them and the assumptions people make.
Well, hearing loss really is equated in many people's minds with aging, and our society is really obsessed with youth. So all those younger people with hearing loss keep it a secret, even people with really severe hearing loss, and that adds to the perception that hearing loss is a condition of the elderly, because the elderly are the only people who are open about it.
Even when people wear hearing aids, they're not perfect, nor are cochlear implants. Talk about some of each technology's limitations.
Well, I always hate to talk negatively about hearing aids, because I think for people with mild to moderate hearing loss, hearing aids are a great help. They work in any kind of sort of small group, or certainly with individuals, with family, friends, at work, watching television or going to the movies. Most daily events. And if you wear a hearing aid, you really should wear it all day long. You shouldn't put it on just to watch television. But the one kind of place that they don't work is places that are very loud. And a lot of people have trouble with restaurants, which tend to be extremely noisy. They also are less successful for people with hearing loss as severe as mine. They need a boost with extra technology. It's really frustrating because the hearing aid manufacturers have a huge potential clientele. Right now, only one in seven people who could use a hearing aid has one. So that's a lot of people who need a hearing aid right this minute. And with our demographics, they're going to get more and more in that group. They have not invested the money for research and development that would make hearing aids work for somebody like me, and eventually I will replace my hearing aid with a cochlear implant. We also need a change not only in the cost of hearing aids, but in how we pay for them. Currently, people are always shocked to hear this. Very few private insurers cover hearing aids in any way. Medicare doesn't cover hearing aids. Obamacare doesn't cover hearing aids. Medicaid, for the most part, doesn't cover hearing aids. And untreated hearing loss is a big public health problem.
There's a little used, at least here, technology called looping that you believe could help millions of people. What is looping? How does it work?
Oh, looping is a great technology. It involves wrapping a wire around a room or between seats in a theater. The wire acts as a transmitter for the speaker, who uses an ordinary microphone. The listener simply switches the program on his hearing aid to telecoil mode, and the sound is suddenly crystal clear. Interestingly, looping works for hearing people, too. Even with perfect hearing, you often can't hear the speaker in a big place or over other noise. And where looping is installed, somebody with hearing can borrow from the venue a simple headset or an earbud, and they can hear the speaker as clearly as if they were in the front row. I first experienced looping a couple of years ago at an annual meeting of the Hearing Loss Association of America, which is a national support and advocacy group. And They have a big meeting every June in one city or another around the country, and hundreds of people attend. And so at that first meeting, I was at a symposium on research in hearing loss, which I was really, really interested in and really wanted to hear. And I didn't think I would be able to hear it, but before the discussion, someone announced that the room was looped and explained how to use your telecoil on your hearing aid. And it was amazing. I heard every word. I still remember that experience so vividly. It was the first time I had heard clearly in probably a good 25 years.
Your book talks about denial when it comes to deafness. People cope rather than admit their hearing is going. But so many of us walk around with those Bluetooth earpieces, earbuds, even full-size headphones. Shouldn't wearing a hearing aid no longer be a big deal?
I think the stigma is beginning to disappear as more and more people acknowledge their hearing loss. But it is still a stigma of aging, what we talked about at the beginning. My goal, one of my main goals in writing and talking about hearing loss is to encourage other people to be open about it, too, and to get it treated.
Former New York Times editor Catherine Boughton is the author of Shouting Won't Help, Why I and 50 Million Other Americans Can't Hear You, from Sarah Crichton Books, Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
Whispering sounds of silence.
Quote from the news, to some extent, the inmates run the asylum. Coaches have a lot of other things to deal with. That was former professional football star Trevor Price on the scandal in which Miami Dolphins and Richie Incognito was suspended after charges of brutally hazing rookie teammate Jonathan Martin.
Next, for Veterans Day, the head of the Navy SEAL Foundation, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. You're not going to wipe out humanity, but if you get unlucky, you could kill 50 million people or collapse the world economy for a century, two centuries. That was former NASA space shuttle astronaut Edward Liu on reports suggesting more frequent strikes ahead by asteroids and other space objects similar to the one that exploded over the Russian city of Chelyabinsk in February. Now this.
Been around the world twice. Talked to everyone once. There ain't nothing I can't do, no sky too high, no sea too rough. Learned a lot of lessons in my life. Never shoot a large caliber man with a small caliber bullet. Anything in life worth doing is worth overdoing. Moderation's for cowards. I'm a lover. I'm a fighter. I'm a UDT Navy SEAL diver.
From the forthcoming feature film Lone Survivor, based on a real-life SEAL team mission gone wrong for the rightest reason, the SEALs' decision not to kill civilians who stumbled upon them before they could eliminate a Taliban leader near the Afghan-Pakistan border. Writer-director Pete Berg embedded himself with SEALs near the Syrian border to capture the spirit of Navy special warriors who've taken on such an expanded role on many fronts in the nation's unending, unconventional war with terror.
The film opens around Christmas, but the clip from it sets the stage for our pre-Veterans Day discussion of SEALs on and off duty, retired or mourned by their survivors. For that chat for your ears only, we're joined by much-decorated SEAL veteran Dave Cooper, new president of the SEAL Foundation at NavySEALFoundation.org. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
First, tell us how long you served with the SEALs and where some of your missions took you.
I served for 25 years in the SEAL teams, and my missions took me all over the world, predominantly Bosnia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, and other lovely places like that.
How do the SEALs differ in mission and tactics from other special warfare units, most notably the Army's Green Berets and Rangers?
Yeah, I could make a joke about that. And, the Army has its model of by, with, and through. I have always said that the SEAL model is more of a over, around, and under to get the job done. But what really separates us is the maritime environment. And prior to 9/11, people thought of SEALs as working solely in the water. Of course, that's wrong. It was a misperception. We use the water, very comfortable in the water, to get to land, and that adds to our capability. It's a capability that the other forces don't have, and really what separates us.
How do most SEALs feel about increasingly being a substitute for conventional boots on the ground in hostile territory, inserting themselves secretly by sea or air to kill or capture and then get away?
Well, if you ask a Navy SEAL how he feels about that, he would say, hey, that's the right thing to do. And that's a complicated question. And it is the right thing to do. We as special operators, be it Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine, Marines are older. We're more mature. We understand a lot of times the risks involved, and we would prefer to be the force that goes in as opposed to, you know, the 18 and 19 year old kids that, you know, are sent to do these types of things. So to us, it's preferable.
As pressure grows at home and abroad against the use of unmanned killer drones, do you see SEAL teams being asked to take over more of those missions?
Yes and no. This comes down to it's not just an easy issue of sovereignty. If I just give Yemen, you know, the administration, the regime in Yemen is amenable to drones, but they are not amenable to American boots on the ground. And we respect those sensibilities, and we don't put boots on the ground, usually except for rare circumstances. So that's a tough question. I mean, it's always going to come down to the individual circumstances that we might find. In some cases, where there's a lack of a credible government, and you know, you'll see groups like the SEALs and some of the Army Special Forces get involved.
Not all ex-SEALs get to head the SEAL Foundation. Talk about the kinds of work most of them get into, beginning with private security, I suppose.
Well, that's an easy segue, right? You go from a life of being a warrior, and a lot of guys make that transition. They do very well in that realm, in the private security realm. Others, though, have a, you know, just SEALs in general are great leaders. We from the word go, we kind of select these guys for many things. One of those leadership ability, and by the time they get out, they are not just great warriors, they're great leaders. So they have this strong entrepreneurial spirit, and many of the guys that get out start their own businesses, doing any number of things, and they're quite successful at it.
Talk about the kind of help the SEAL Foundation provides in terms of education and employment, other than the obvious private security firms.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the Navy SEAL Foundation exists wholly to support our active duty members and their families, and particularly the families of the fallen. And we do that in so many ways. 49 programs aimed, as I said, at the active duty and the families and the families of the fallen. And education is one of those programs that we support wholeheartedly. We quite frankly value, highly esteem a rich education. So we provide financial assistance in the form of scholarships. And it really just, it's not so much that it relieves the financial burden. It does, of course, but it also just opens up doors, because we know a life of military service doesn't always afford our service members the opportunity to send their bright children to some of our nation's finer schools. So we open up these doors that might otherwise have been closed to them.
Does the high stress of SEAL missions mean more physical and mental challenges after retirement? And what sort of assistance does the SEAL Foundation provide in that area?
Yeah, you've touched upon something that we're all asking ourselves. We know that stress, a lifetime of stress, has similar effects. It's not unlike playing, you know, football for 20 years, and the cumulative effects of the stress. We don't yet know necessarily what those effects are going to be, only that we're going to have to deal with this in the future. So what we're doing now is, through the Naval Special Warfare Community, looking at ways to fund relevant studies to at least provide us with some insight into where we need to go for tomorrow. We know tomorrow's going to change, and we want to be ready for it, and we want to help our teammates.
Highly decorated SEAL veteran Dave Cooper was recently named president of the SEAL Foundation at NavySEALFoundation.org.
The Navy hymn by the Navy Band Sea Chanters. Next, the two other Wizards of Oz, Somewhere Over the Rainbow writers Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg, for your ears only.
A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Yummy, daddy-like. That, according to court papers, was a Facebook message from U.S. Navy Commander Jose Luis Sanchez after contractor Leonard Glenn Francis offered to arrange prostitutes for him and his buddies in Malaysia. Both men and several others were arrested in connection with an alleged lavish bribery scheme. Now this.
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. With the thoughts I'd be thinking, I could be another Lincoln if I only had a brain.
There were really three Wizards of Oz. Actor Frank Morgan was revealed behind the curtain in the 1939 film. Composer Harold Arlen and lyricist E.Y. Yuppiger remained unseen but supplied the musical magic that helped make it a classic, including those optimistic lines for The Tin Woodsman, sung by veteran cabaret vocalist Karen Oberlin. The same magic manifested itself in earlier and later songs they wrote together and apart, including Last Night When We Were Young, Happiness Is Just a Thing Called Joe, That Old Black Magic, and Old Devil Moon.
Oberlin celebrates the work of those two other Wizards of Oz on November 14th at the Café Carlyle, and from the 26th through the 30th of this month at the new Crazy Cox Cabaret in London. But for your ears only, she's on the line now with a preview. Karen, welcome back to our show.
Oh, it's so great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Arlen wrote his first well-known song, Get Happy, in 1929, and a lot of other hits before reaching Oz, including Stormy Weather. Harburg wrote the Depression dirge, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, in 1932, and they even collaborated with one another before The Wizard, producing a song you sing in the new show that Arlen considered his favorite. Talk about the special charm you find in Last Night When We Were Young.
Oh, well, it has an interesting story. It is one of my favorite songs of their work together. But Arlen had written that melody and had shown it to, you know, his good friends, his neighbors like George and Ira Gershwin, Jerome Kern. And they thought it was haunting. They thought it was beautiful, but they didn't think anyone could sing it. They didn't think that it could really work as a song. And then he went back to his occasional collaborator as they were starting to work together again, Yip Harburg, and Harburg immediately fell in love with it. The title came spilling out of him, and so did the lyrics.
The two of them also wrote an angrier, funnier take on romance for a Broadway musical called Hooray for What that you'll sing this week.
Down with Love. It's comedic, too, which I think is one of the reasons that so much of the social and civil rights issues that Harburg especially wanted to bring to the fore in pretty much every Broadway show he ever wrote, he could get away with a lot of that because there was so much humor in what he did.
We read that it was a rainbow Harburg saw over Hollywood Sunset Boulevard that prompted him to write Somewhere Over, well, you know, we all know. How does a performer like you try to find a different or a special way to present such a familiar song?
Well, it is tricky, you know. And I am going to sing it, but in my Harburg show, when I had a show years ago that was just purely devoted to Yip Harburg, I had him singing it in a video to open the show, which is so moving, coming right into the verse out of talking about how the world has changed. And then he just sort of segues right into the song, to the lyrics, and then speaking first, and it's very, very moving. He used to perform his material quite often. But I am going to sing it, and we have a sort of a rhythmic different take, but there's also a whole bridge and chorus that was cut from the film. There was a reprise where Judy Garland is in the witch's castle, and she sings a little of the song, and that ended up on the editing room floor. But I will revive it in this show, and that's fun because it's actually just as good as the rest of the song. But I would do it for you now, but, you know, I want people to show up at the Carlyle.
Arlen and Harburg worked together again on a 1939 Marx Brothers movie called At the Circus. Talk about the comic song that became a Groucho trademark and maybe your favorite funny line or two.
It did become his signature song, and it was almost...
We should say it's Lydia the Tattooed Lady.
Lydia the Tattooed Lady. And Harburg actually used to write topical lyrics when he would perform the song long after the long after Groucho Marx had been singing it, and he would write funny lines like, when she stands, her hips look littler. When she sits on Hitler. When she stands, she's 6 foot six, and when she sits on Nixon, depending on the politics of the day. So there are more of those to come. But, well, yes, it was, they had to save the virtue of Lydia to keep the film, song in the film. Otherwise, we might never have known it because the censors wanted very badly to, cut it from the film, and they had to work very hard. I tell a little of that story in the show, too, which is pretty dramatic, how they were desperate to save this song. And where would we be without a song like Lydia the Tattooed Lady, I ask you?
Veteran cabaret performer Karen Oberlin celebrates Arlen and Harburg at 10:45 p.m. on November 14th at the Café Carlyle. That's 35 East 76th Street in New York. And November 26th through the 30th in the Crazy Cox Cabaret in London.
Last night, when we were young, love was a star, a song unsung. Life was so new, so real, so right. Ages ago. Last night.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with interns Sarah Skirmont and Gene Moon. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org Radio Reading Service for those with disabilities, the Jed Foundation, Fighting Campus Suicide, and award-winning ACAM Associates, Exceptional Management, Impeccable Reputation for New York Co-ops, Condos, and Condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com, and please pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Jean Moon. This week, however, we dig back a bit further to mark the passing at age 91 of Yiddish music historian and archivist Hanna Mlotek, who talked with us about the Jewish roots of so much American popular song from our June 10th, 2012 broadcast hosted by David and Eddie Robinson.
You are the answer to my lonely prayer.
At a New York gathering not long ago, early rock and roll star Neil Sedaka sang one of his many hits, You Mean Everything to Me, and paid tribute to the inspiration he got as a boy in the 1940s from Yiddish songs for honoring and continuing the legacy of Jewish music in America, with evident echoes in the works of the Gershwin brothers, Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, Richard Rodgers, Oscar Hammerstein, and many more. Sedaka himself will be celebrated this week at a gala concert in New York's Town Hall.
Also celebrated will be one of the nation's foremost scholars of Yiddish music and its impact on American culture, long before and since Sedaka. She's Hanna Mlotek of the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. And to talk about her work, Sedaka, songs both in Yiddish and echoing it, For Your Ears Only, we're pleased to have Ms. Mlotek on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
First off, what got you interested in studying, preserving, and archiving Yiddish music?
Well, I was always interested in Yiddish songs. My family was a Yiddish-speaking one and a Yiddish-singing one. I went to a Yiddish school. I went to a Yiddish camp. And then in 1944, I became the assistant to Max Weinreich, who was the founder of YIVO and one of the foremost Yiddish linguists.
How many Yiddish songs and tunes have you identified and archived, and how do you find them?
Well, I find them now in my column that my husband and I started in 1970, where readers started sending us songs and snippets of songs and asking us to identify them. They sent them the letters telling them about the origins of songs of Providence, and sometimes they sent us cassettes and tapes. I've archived about several thousand songs.
There's a famous anecdote about the WASP songwriter Cole Porter telling Richard Rodgers he decided to write more what he called Jewish tunes. And Rodgers did find Eastern Mediterranean undertones in Porter's Night and Day, Begin the Begin, even Love for Sale. How do you define the Jewish or Yiddish qualities of so many great old American songs?
Well, I believe that it is said that Cole Porter said, was heard saying that he would put the songs in minor, write songs in minor, and that would give them a Jewish quality. You have a song that he wrote, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which comes from the Yiddish Ailey Ailey.
How do you explain how songwriting from the 1920s through the 50s was so appealing to and successful for so many American Jews?
Well, I think at that period, music songwriting was popular not only for Jews but for everybody. We had the influence of movies, of radio, and the songs of Gershwin and Berlin were so popular among all people. The Jewish element was used to seeing the songs in the Yiddish theater in the earlier period, and they loved these songs. There was a fine song printing press, a few of them that were going on and publishing sheet music, and it was very popular at that time.
There are Yiddish lyrics to many American songs, even Irving Berlin's White Christmas, but I only know of one or two English versions of Yiddish songs, And the Angels Sing and Bamir Bist Du Shein. Are there many other Yiddish songs that you'd like to see translated into English?
Well, there's a song that the Fred Waring Orchestra used to sing, I Love You Much Too Much, which was a translation of Chabir Tzufil Lieb by Alexander Oshanetsky. There's a song, Schweig Mein Herz, which became Nature Boy.
You've helped other contemporary Jewish entertainers beyond Neil Sedaka to learn or relearn old Yiddish songs. Talk about that.
Well, we had Mandy Patinkin, who became interested in his Yiddish roots and gave a few concerts of Yiddish song. We were at his home, and he was listening to us discuss the dialects and the variations of the songs. We had a singer, Judy Blazer, who sang in the Tomaszewski program, Michael Tilson Thomas's program about his grandparents, Boris and Bessie Tomaszewski. And she came to me at the YIVO, and I coached her a little, but my son, Zalman Lutzik, really coached her for the part. And she sang some of the old songs, the old Yiddish songs. I don't know too many, but I know that there's an interest among these singers of Yiddish songs. They sing the popular ones like Rajin Kisamanlin or Eifem Pripichik Ben Dafayadon. But we try to help whatever we can do.
Chana Blotek has been called a Sherlock Holmes of Yiddish music by no less an authority than Nobel Prize-winning author Isaac Bashevis Singer. She's being honored at New York's Town Hall June 12th by the Folkspine National Yiddish Theater, along with rock and roll pioneer Neil Sedaka and Dr. H.J. Wisnicki of the Union Square Eye Care.
Now another take on Jewish music from Irving Berlin, as sung by our friend Maud Maggard, currently appearing at Feinstein's Cabaret in New York's Lowe's Regency Hotel.
Yiddish nightingale, sing me a song. Your voice has got such sweetness that it makes me strong. Yiddish nightingale, sing me a song. I promise that I'll take you on a long honeymoon.
American Song, Yiddish Roots, from our June 10th, 2012 broadcast. Having released a book of verse in 2010, Hannah Mlotek was back at work on her 9th anthology of Yiddish songs when she died last week. Her sons continued the family focus with Zalman, a successful composer, conductor, and arranger, now artistic director of the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, and his brother Moish, the president of its board of directors. In the works, as conceived by Zalman, is Miracle of Miracles, a Hanukkah extravaganza at New York's Symphony Space Theater on December 2nd, celebrating legendary folk singer, actor, and activist Theodore Bacall in his 90th year. The first Baron von Trapp in The Sound of Music on Broadway, Bacall also starred as Tevye in 2000 Broadway performances of Fiddler on the Roof and appeared in films including The Blue Angel, The Defiant Ones, and The Russians Are Coming. I'm Jean Moon. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Karen Oberlin with All of Last Night When We Were Young by Jewish songwriters Hyman Arlick and Isidor Hochberg, better known as Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg.
Last night, when we were young, love was a star, a song unsung. Life was so new, so real, so right. Ages ago, last night, today, the world is old. You flew away, and time grew cold. Where is that star that seemed so bright ages ago? Last night, to think that spring had depended on merely this, a look, a kiss. To think that something so splendid could slip away in one little daybreak. So now, let's reminisce and recollect the sighs and the kisses, the arms that close.